Okay, we are just past the 7:30, so I think I will go ahead now, and if I can find my buttons and everything like that, I will mute all. And as usual, everybody has the ability to unmute themselves, and please feel free to do so if you have a question or a comment. Later on this evening, the contents of the deck in PDF format, the chat, and the audio track will be available through our website. And we've got quite a lot of material to go through tonight, so Alan, take it away.
I think we have a lot of material, but I think some of them are quite short, so I'm thinking we'll get through the whole bunch tonight. Anyway, let's see how we do. We'd like to start off with a follow-up from a while ago. We were talking about temporary email addresses, and Eldon found this one on the web and sent it in. So if you're in need of a disposable email address that, as it says, it's temporary, it only lasts for a certain amount of time, then incognitomail.co is the URL, and you can get a temporary email address from them. Next up, Jeff has a couple of interesting shares. If you try to connect to a website and it doesn't produce a 404 error, no kind of error detected, then one thing to do is to check your system tray to make sure that you are connected to the internet. But if everything on your system is working, then the question is the website running? So this one is called Down for Everyone or Just Me. And if you click on that link and then enter, it asks you to enter a URL. So I asked it about OPCUG, and there it says at the bottom, it's just you. OPCUG is up. So I couldn't find one that was down. So I imagine if it's down, it can tell you, nope, it's everything's down. And the second one, similar kind of thing, is called Down Detector. And this time I asked about YouTube, and there were no reports of problems at YouTube. So that one is also up. Next up, a share from Stuart. Stuart's here, so he can unmute himself and tell us all about power adapters.
I guess this is my fault, so I better talk to it. I was reading a little article on someone touting the advantages of a little Google TV projector she had bought. The only problem with it was that she didn't have a good battery power source for it, and she had found one of these units on Amazon. And it's essentially just a barrel connector, like any monitor or power drill or Google TV projector might happen to have, that plugs into a USB port. And assuming you've got the enough power coming out of your USB hub or port or whatever you're plugging it into, and the cable is strong enough to carry it, you can power all kinds of things besides computer accessories. As I said, you can even charge a power drill off your computer if you wanted to, and you had lost the power adapter for it. So, I'm currently in the process of looking for a powerful enough USB hub to plug in my two monitors so I can toss the power bricks off the desk and save myself a little space. If you have a device that needs to be charged through this kind of a connection and you've lost the power adapter, well, you can find a cable on Amazon that might let you charge your device. Good luck.
Okay, thanks very much, Stuart. Okay, we're still working our way through the questions that came in response to the survey when we asked what was the one thing that you would like to know more about. And this one was basically what's an easy way to back up my computer to an external drive. So I created a little mini series, and we're going to start off tonight with looking at full disk backup images. And then next time we'll look at how to recover them and all these other things. So basically, we're going to talk about image backup. And essentially, the disk imaging, you can create a full backup, or you can have an incremental backup over a period of time of the entire disk drive. And that includes, and I'm sure everybody knows, we've talked about this lots of times, it's basically a bit-for-bit copy of the entire drive. So you've got the operating system, typically Windows, and all the installed applications, all the configuration options that you've applied, and all of your personal data files. So everything that's on your disk, operating system, programs, data, will be end up in this image file. So most of these programs, and the one I'm going to talk about in particular, you can restore from that image the entire drive. So you put the entire drive back to the moment in time when you made the backup. Or, and I find this very handy, you can recover just single partitions. So in my case, everybody knows I dual boot Linux and Windows. Most frequently, I blow the Linux system away, and by just restoring the Linux partition, I can be back up and running in a couple of minutes. So that's a really handy feature for me. The other thing that's very useful, a lot of imaging programs will let you mount the image file. And you mount it, and so it looks like a virtual hard drive, essentially. So if you've got multiple partitions, you tell it which partition you want to mount. It gives it a drive letter in Windows. And so you might have like drive E, for example. That's a virtual drive that's pointing at the image file, and then you can restore individual files or multiple files or folders or multiple folders. So if you just want one image, one file, rather than restoring the whole drive or the whole partition, you can actually mount the image and just restore that one individual file that you're missing or is corrupt or is outdated or whatever. And then the final thing, if you're going to recover the system partition, you can't run the recovery program from Windows and recover Windows. Windows won't let you overwrite itself. So you have to have a bootable USB drive called a rescue disk or recovery drive, whatever you want to call it. And so you need to create that ahead of time, hopefully, or otherwise you're locked into finding a second machine that you can use to create the recovery disk. So in beautiful pictures, here's your hard drive on the left. Let's say it's just a Windows partition. You've got some hidden system partitions, recovery partitions, that kind of thing. But the whole hard drive gets copied to an image file, and you can recover that whole hard drive using the restore command. And I said that if you have multiple partitions, and you could have a Windows partition with a dedicated data partition. I have Windows and Linux and data, so I have basically three major partitions that I might want to restore in addition to all the recovery, the system folder system partitions. So those two operating systems and data are the partitions I'd be interested in trying to recover. The program that Chris really likes is Easus To Do Backup, and in particular the free edition. It basically does everything you will probably want, and if you need the extras, then they're always bugging you to buy the pro version. So when you try and download it, you've got the big blue button there for the free download, but you notice that on the same screen they're offering you 50% if you buy the the pro version of the software. But you can just click on the free download and install the program. And when you run the program, the first thing you'll see is an offer, another offer to upgrade to the pro version. And they'll keep doing that kind of stuff. But you notice down the bottom here, it's got this little checkbox that says, don't show this again. So if you check that, then at least it gets rid of this box right here. So the main screen is create a backup. That's what we're going to start off doing. So let's hit the create a backup. And that will take us into a wizard. And so we have to select what's the drive that we want to back up. Well, we want to back up our local hard drive. So let's choose disk. Here's our main hard drive. Here are all the different partitions. There's the C drive. Here's my data drive. And then these things are all recovery partitions mainly. System partitions anyway, of one sort or another. That's a boot partition right there. Diagnostics over here. But we're just going to say everything's checked by default. So we're just going to say, okay, just do that. And it's by default, the program has seen that I have a D drive, so it's decided I want to create a folder called My Backups on drive D. I actually don't want to do that, so I'm going to click on this D drive thing right here, and I'm going to choose, well, I still want a local drive, and now I can browse the tree directory here. See, it's by default, it's taken my D drive. I'm going to actually scroll down here and find my external USB, which is a 1 terabyte passport directory. I want it to go into the Z images folder, and you notice I've already got some backup images for a smartphone, a laptop, and a hybrid tablet computer. I want to create another one now, so I'm going to choose new folder. I'm going to create a folder called ESUS, so I know that these are the backups I'm creating with ESUS to do backup. So now I can select that folder. So we're in Passport, Z Images, and ESUS. I'm just going to say OK. And now we've got kind of a summary. We're going to back up the solid state drive, 250 gigs. So that's my main hard drive. We're going to go to the P drive, which you remember is the external USB, the Passport. We're going to Z Images and ESUS, and now we just hit the magic button, backup now. And it will go through some progress. You'll get a progress report, what's going on, and eventually you'll see this, which says the backup is completed. And you notice that it gives you the option, or it tells you that you can schedule this task. What you've done now is you've created the backup task. You're going to back up the main hard drive to this external USB. And you could schedule that every month or every week or every day, whatever you want. I'm actually not going to bother doing that. I just do it manually. But here's the job we've created. They call it disk zero. I could have actually edited that when we were playing and call it something a bit more reasonable. Anyway, there's the disk. There's the job to back up the hard drive to the external USB. We can come back to that later on. But let's go and have a look at the USB. So here is the USB, here's the P drive, Z Images, ESUS, and it's created a folder called disk zero. And inside disk zero is this file, disk zero, and then it's got the date, right? Year, month, day. It's a full backup, and this is version one. So if I'd done a second one on the same day, I'd presumably get a version two. If you do incremental backups, then you've got a series of these kind of things. But maybe they'll have different names, but they'll all be in the same folder. So that's really all there is to it. You install the program, run it, run the backup wizard, tell it what disk you want to back up, tell it where you want to store it, and say backup now, and the magic happens. Really simple. That's what the question was. How can I easily back up my hard drive to an external USB? That's how you can do it.
We have a question from Steve. Can you add files to your drive image file? Presumably he's talking about when you've mounted it.
I don't know. I've never tried to do that.
No, you can't. It is open to buy EaseUS to do backup as opposed to File Explorer. In terms of the internal workings of it, it exposes the drive letter through File Explorer, but it is a read-only volume.
So you can't add to it.
You wouldn't want to try. We have one other question. Are there any programs that organize, compress, or encrypt disks partitions and use FTP to back over the internet where you have access to storage?
Yes, you can do that with FreeFileSync, for example. You can tell it to use an FTP server to back up to.
You could actually do it with EaseUS to do backup. It has the ability to encrypt the backup files, and the files that it creates, you could then schedule it all through or script it to FTP it to somewhere else if you wanted.
Okay, I see a couple of other questions there. Why do I prefer to backup manually rather than schedule it? One of the things is I never leave my external USB plugged in. If I got hit by ransomware and my USB was plugged in, presumably it would encrypt the USB drive as well. So I don't leave it plugged in. So that means I'd have to remember to plug it in before the schedule was due. Personally, I only do it once a month to kind of align with Patch Tuesday. I have backups of my data every day, every time I use the computer, so I'm not worried about data. And the operating system and the programs, they don't change very rapidly anyway. So I'm happy if I need to restore the image backup and then just update the operating system, Windows Update, and update any application programs and then reload my data. So a manual backup process works just fine for me, but that's just my preference.
Yeah, on the other hand, I back up using EaseUS on a schedule basis, and I have it run at 1 o'clock in the morning every day. So that's my main backup, and so it catches all my data as well as the operating system and programs and everything like that.
Is that incremental, Chris?
Yeah, I do incrementals. So it means that I will never lose more than 1 day's worth of work if I count on that as my what I have to turn to do the back to do a restore. I have a number of other things I do backups with as well. But yeah, and the incrementals, they run in under 5 minutes when I run them every day.
And the other question here is, once you make a boot USB with EaseUS, do you need to update it? I don't think you do. I mean, it's pretty basic the way I use it anyway, backup and restore. So
I did have one time. I never used to update them. And then not too long ago, I decided that I wanted to test my recovery processes. So I wanted to boot from that recovery media, and it actually had a problem accessing the backup files that had been made with a more recent version of To Do Backup. And when I updated the recovery disk, it worked fine. So it seems like it's certainly not every time there's an update to the program, but there may be some times where there's something fundamentally changes and you do need to update it. What I usually tell people with that recovery disk is that, or the flash drive you create, it's really, really important when you first install EaseUS to do backup that you actually create it then. And it's not so that you can do recovery, but it's so that you can test whether you can boot with that flash drive, whether you can boot your computer, and whether you can access your backup drive when you're booted from that recovery media. After that, I don't particularly care, because as long as I know that it functions, if it turns out that there's any problem with it, I can create that on any computer. So any computer at all, I just download To Do Backup free, create the recovery media, and it'll work on any computer. So I say you don't have to update it every time. Periodically updating is probably not a bad idea.
Okay, thanks very much, Chris. And the next share is yours.
Okay, thank you. And so, App Control. This is a neat program I just came across. It's brand new. It was released in February of this year. And for anybody who's interested, it was actually this company. It was created by the one of the principals who made Glasswire, which is another interesting program that I've talked about in the past. So he's come up with this free replacement for Task Manager. And so it has all kinds of features built into it. So it can track real-time as well as historical resource usage. So CPU, memory, GPU, disk, temperature usage for the CPU and GPU, although he doesn't break it out as separate numbers. So I'm not exactly sure how he comes up with a single number for the temperature of CPU and GPU. And we can get real-time out of Task Manager for all of those things, well, for CPU, RAM, GPU, and disk, and so forth. But you can't get historical data, whereas with App Control, you can. You can actually go back in time and see how that was 5 minutes ago or an hour ago or whatever. You can also get privacy alerts. So this is kind of neat. When programs try to access or do access your webcam, microphone, or location, you can actually get alerts that, you know, such and such program has actually accessed one of those. That's kind of neat. You can disable or block problem programs. So Task Manager has the ability to kill a process, but it can come back. And so this, if you have a problem app and say it's maybe it's even malware and it just keeps coming back, you can actually go and disable it. And I'll show an example of using that in a second. And then also, which is really nice, is the ability for the program to describe apps that are running on your program in plain language, who the publisher was, what the program is designed to do, whether it's a trustworthy program, that sort of thing. So the activity screen, this is a little bit of an eye chart here, but we'll just go through some of the highlights of what it can actually do. So you can hover the graph over the top of the graph with your mouse, and you'll see details for that point in time of all of the different metrics for performance. You can click on the graph to see all of the processes at that point in time. You can monitor your PC temperature. I haven't really played around with all that much on that. You can actually set the preference of how long it will track things going back so you can see historically what was running on your computer, anywhere from 5 minutes to 3 days. And then I've got information about this on the next slide, so we'll skip over that. And then I'm not getting forwards. There we go. Oh, now it's jumping forward. Okay. So you can have a slide that goes across the bottom that you can actually expand up or compress down to see things in a wider range or a narrower range. You can sort the list at the bottom by resource usage, which is I find the most useful, but you can also do it by publisher or the type of app it is, and then there's navigation buttons across the bottom of the screen. So if we look at some of the other things that you can actually access, if you click the chevron beside any process that is in the list, it'll actually come up with this really, really nice detailed look at what that particular app will do. So at the top, you can kill it, or you can disable it. So kill it will allow it to run again. Disable it will prevent it from ever running on your computer again until you re-enable it. And it does it not through the program. So it actually disables it at the file system level where you just cannot run it, period. Then you have the hardware usage list for that particular process. So the CPU utilization, the memory, and the disk utilization. There's the about where it'll actually tell you who published it, what it's used for, and some other details about it. So if you have some unknown process, you can take a look at it, see some details. Some more details about, you know, when it was created and things like that, the publisher of it, whether it's a signed app, things like that. What account launched the program? So normally it'll be your account, so it'll be computer name, / and your user ID, but you can also see programs that were actually started by the system. And I think that shows up as system, / NT authority or something like that. And then other accesses that it has. So this particular program had access to my microphone. And so if it also had access to camera or location, they would show up in the list as well. So really nice that it exposes all that information about the apps that are running on your computer. On the events tab, you can see all kinds of things about when apps are launched, when they're updated, And this I find a little bit on the busy side, and I'm not sure if it's a bug or not. I'm going to have to go back to the publisher on it. I'll come back to this slide information a little bit later on. So on the alerts, you can actually select what type of alerts you actually want to have. By default, it won't alert you of any of them. I have them all selected except for new app launch in this case. So I have no notifications for that. So some of these get very busy. You get an awful lot of pop-ups talking about when apps are updated. It's amazing how many apps get updated in the background that you don't know about. You can tune that down if you decide really don't want to have that many pop-ups. This one here, I said new app launch. This is one of the ones I turned off. And that was because it generated a huge number of alerts. And an update to Google Chrome actually generated 6 pop-ups saying that Google Chrome had been updated. Now, again, I don't know if that's a bug or if it's sub-processes, or I don't know what caused that to have 6 updates. You can have the alert levels either on or off, or you can turn on a do not disturb. And that's what I've done right now so that I don't have any pop-ups coming up while I'm showing anything, or, well, nothing showing from my computer anyways. But you can turn off the notifications for a period of time, and I think you can do it up to 5 hours that you can turn them off, and then it'll turn on automatically again for you. Disabling apps. On any app, you can go in and you can actually kill it, or you can disable it. And if you do disable it, it warns you that this is going to disable it permanently until you come back in the program to actually re-enable it. So it gives you a bit of a warning. I tried running AEDW Cleaner after I disabled it, and this is what it popped up with. So Windows cannot access the specified file or whatever. So what they've done is right at the file system level, they've disabled the ability for me to actually run that or access that particular file. And then re-enabling it, you just come back into the program. You go into the apps tab, and then you can go under the where it says activities and disabled. Click on disabled. It'll list all of the apps that you've disabled, and then you can re-enable them if you want to. I mentioned you can see what apps are accessing your camera, microphone, or location, and so you can turn on or off any of those, so you don't have them all on. I turn them all on, and then I see, for example, Google Chrome has access to all 3. And I can see down further Perplexity, which I can actually talk to Perplexity if I want to. So it has microphone access, makes sense. Doesn't have camera access, doesn't have location access, sort of makes sense for that. And then Zoom has access to camera and microphone. So you can very clearly see what apps are able to access your those resources. And if you find some app that has more access than you want to give it, then you go into Settings, Privacy and Security, App Permissions, and you can toggle those off for that particular app. And there I'm toggling off camera access for Feedback Hub. I don't need Feedback Hub to have access to my camera, so I just can toggle that off. I think it's a pretty impressive program. It has lots more capabilities than Task Manager has for monitoring resource usage on your computer. The author says they plan to come out with a paid premium version, but they're promising that the current functionality will always be free, and they haven't talked about what they actually want to put into the premium version. So overall, I think it's really worth checking out, and free of charge, so why not? Any questions?
Natalie says she's been using it, but the list of things that show starting up when I open the program are sometimes confusing. They're not obvious. Is that something you can control with those settings?
In terms of the confusion of it, you can definitely go to any of those processes that are being started and click on them, and it will tell you about what that particular process does. It can be a huge list of things, that's for sure.
And Tom wants to know if you can disable auto-started stuff like services.
Not from that interface. It can. So you would still have to use other means, whatever you currently use, for auto-starting of services through the services app or the regular applications through startup or whatever application you use to control startup apps now. You'd have to continue using them.
Okay, that's everything in the chat. Okay. The share is yours too.
Okay, we'll move on to the next one. Next one is traffic monitor. So this was, again, I was playing around looking for various applications that will expose resource usage on a computer. So I came across this one, Traffic Monitor, free and open source. It's available through GitHub. And it was really designed, as the name applies, traffic. So it really is looking at traffic going in and out of your computer. But it also does have the ability to display CPU usage. And let me just paste these last couple of things into the chat while I'm thinking about it. So it can also display the CPU memory usage. So it used to be, and under Windows 11, I found this really neat utility called X-Meters from Entropy 6, and it would display on your taskbar. You could see those four metrics, CPU, storage, or disk writes or reads, network activity, as well as the memory usage. And you could turn on, toggle them on or off, each of them, and you could display them in various ways. Really, really neat app. So it didn't work in Windows 11. And I wrote the author three times asking if he was going to make a version that would work in Windows 11, and I never heard a reply back from him. So I no longer have any Windows 10 computers, so unfortunately for me, X-Meters is no longer an option. So Traffic Monitor is kind of neat. It does run on Windows 10 or 11. And by default, it will display this floating box, as you see on the screen, highlighted in red. And it will show upload and download traffic, which is, as the name implies, traffic monitor. So you can drag it anywhere you want on the screen, and you can have various levels of transparency. You can have mouse click through so that you can click on the screen underneath it, and the mouse click won't be caught by the traffic monitor screen, which is kind of neat. You can also click on the options for it, and you can say show more info. And when you do that, you will actually see, in addition, CPU activity and memory usage, which is what I'm interested in more than traffic. So I can go in on that. I can put it onto the taskbar. So if I go to the configuration, I say show taskbar window, then I will actually see it on the taskbar down near the system tray. And so that's kind of neat. And by default, again, it just showed network traffic, but if I right-click on it and I say display settings, I can actually switch that so that I'm only showing CPU usage and memory usage, which is what I'm really interested in. And so for me, now all of a sudden traffic monitor is a pretty cool way for me to be able to have, at a glance, I can see CPU activity and memory usage. And so if I'm having a sluggish computer, I just glance at that and see if, oh, my CPU is running at 99%, and then I can track down what application is actually causing that problem, or my memory usage is 95%, and so I can see, oh, what runaway process do I have that's gobbling up all my memory, that sort of thing as well. So if you hover the mouse over the main or the taskbar icon, you get additional information, as you see on the screen there, which is kind of nice. So final words on this, I think Traffic Monitor is a very, very good program for that at a glance, being able to just see it without actually clicking on anything, without bringing up Task Manager, you can see that CPU usage and your memory utilization. It is really highly configurable. There's lots of options that I haven't talked about at all yet, colors, fonts that are used, ways it's aligned, everything like that. One minor problem, the GitHub project is in Chinese. And although the page that I pointed to is actually an English page, a lot of the screenshots are actually in Chinese, and so they haven't bothered to translate those. The main program is completely in English, no problem with that. Browser will translate the project pages to English, no problem. But as I said, some of the screenshots are in Chinese, so you have to sort of guess at them a little bit. There is a little bit of bleed through of Chinese characters in the program itself, but it's mostly in just these additional skins for the program that display things in a little bit of different layout and so forth. A couple of those skins, it bleeds through as the Chinese characters come through on that. And I think that's it for me. So
Tom says that Glasswire also does this. I think he means putting the RAM and CPU usage on the screen.
Yeah, it doesn't put it on the taskbar, though, and that's the thing that I really wanted, was the ability to just at a glance see those metrics exposed. I can also go into Task Manager and I can get the numbers really easily as well. I don't want to have to load Task Manager if I just want to be able to say, oh, something is sluggish, and I look down and I say, well, it's not CPU, it's not memory, so it must be something else. Maybe it's a slow web page or something like that. So I really like that idea of it just being able to display it right on the taskbar, and it doesn't take very much room.
Also, system internals can also display a variety of things on your taskbar. I have it displaying the four main uses of resources.
Okay. Yeah, I might do another one on that because there's on this particular topic because there's one of the power toys actually has the ability to expose this information constantly as well. And because PowerToys has some other functionality they might want to take advantage of, having this as well might be useful. So probably next week I'll have something on that.
The other question I had, Chris, is there a free version of Glasswire?
Yeah, there is. The biggest thing about the free version of Glasswire is that it doesn't do any actual blocking. It's more of a reporting tool. But outside of its blocking capability, I think most of the functionality of Glasswire is available for free.
And Steve wants to know if Traffic Monitor can display temperatures.
No, not to my knowledge. I didn't notice it in there. I didn't go hunting for it. But I don't believe it has that capability.
HW Info can display a whole variety of temperatures and other things on your taskbar.
HD Sentinel does too. That's what I use for drives.
Ditto.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. Next up we have a Looney Link. Elizabeth sent us this link to the Hinton Lectures from 2025. Basically a Problems Facing Humanity series. Interesting questions asked by the moderator and the audience. Why would AI turn malicious anyway? I like that one. So there's a series of, three lectures there on YouTube, and there's the main link to go and find those. So if you're interested in that kind of thing, then there is a resource for you. And Jeff has another share for us. Jeff, do you want to talk to this one?
Yeah, we could do. Okay, anybody who's been to my webpage at any time or sat through some of my talks, either at the library or at the club meetings over the years, you probably know that I've often spoke about cutting the cord and various ways to access either media content or music content or VoIP telephony. One of the things I came across recently was this website called channelsurfer.tv. And it's a platform where various channels are aggregated in one spot. And it's predominantly YouTube channels that present themselves very much as your cable or satellite would present itself. So the layout in that regards is much similar. We could move to the next slide.
The layout's at the end here.
There we go. That's the layout. So you can select your channels and you can see what's on in different times. And there's various channels. There were a couple that I've actually, they're predominantly YouTube channels, but they seem to be presenting themselves as like a regular pre-scheduled, pre-programmed channel. There was one sort of science mystery sort of channel that I actually watched it for a few hours. It was quite interesting, some of the stuff. But you can move and navigate through the EPG, the electronic program guide. some of the settings that I found about the About page, I couldn't really find them. So I don't know if that's something that might be more suitable for the Android version. But if anybody would like to take a look at it, do feel free at channelsurfer.tv. And all the content is there. You'll have some fun with it.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Jeff. And Josh wants to know, are channels like PBS geo-blocked?
I don't see PBS on channelsurfer.tv. However, the PBS can be accessed through other means.
Yeah, the problem I had was it says explore channels by region or content type and locate free and otherwise hard to find international broadcasts. They must be hard to find because I couldn't find them.
Yeah, I don't know. I never tried setting to access it if there's some sort of an Android app. I just stumbled upon it, and when I looked at a couple of channels, they were interesting enough that I put it on the media streaming page on my website, because certainly there's so many options nowadays that it's impossible to remember them all or bookmark them all. So that's why I keep them aggregated in one area on the web.
Yeah, you say it's primarily sourced from YouTube. I think that's true. All the ones I looked at, I think, were from YouTube. But some interesting stuff here. I mean, it's got stuff about the Commodore PC, and it's got the I Love Linux WAN show. I mean, what's not to love about this thing?
there was a science drama show that was that I watched, and there seemed to be some archaeological stuff on there, documentaries. This is exactly the sort of programming I watch. I tend to watch anyways, Smithsonian sort of stuff. So I found a couple of channels on it that were interesting.
Yeah. Elizabeth wants to know, what about BritBox without GeoBlock might be accessible? BritBox won't be on this thing, I'm sure. It's a paid subscription service.
Yeah, no, you won't find that on here.
Okay, thanks very much, Jeff.
On the main page of that, it says watch YouTube like you're watching cable. So, yeah, it's all YouTube linked.
And it's like watching cable because it has this channel guide thing, basically, so you can choose as they come along.
Yes.
Yes, and it's aggregated in one place, so it makes it... It would be maybe one of these days I'll try to develop some sort of an interface that does something similar but a little more broad based.
Okay, thanks very much, Jeff. Next up, we have some computer basics from Chris.
Yeah, yet another keyboard shortcut. So we're up to number 6. So keyboard shortcuts are all about the idea that as your hands are on your keyboard, don't have to reach for the mouse to actually do something, find something to click on, and things like that. You can just keep your hands on the keyboard, do a keyboard shortcut to perform some function, and it's much quicker and easier. So today's shortcut is toggling application windows full screen. So the idea is that you maximize the program window, you remove a lot of the lowercase Chrome, the fancy stuff, menus, toolbars, things like that, and it gives more space for the actual content that is what you're really in that application for. And again, then, F11 is the keyboard shortcut for it. So it works in browsers, and it works in some other programs. So things like I've tested in VLC Media Player, Windows Paint, Foxit Reader, and I'm sure there are other ones that it'll work in as well. Just try it out. If it works, it's really handy. It's a toggle, so you hit it a second time to return the window to the normal state. So if we see our normal browser window, looks like this, and if we hit F11, basically it removes all the information you see highlighted in red. So So up at the top, you see your tabs, you see the URL bar, you see your favorites bar, and then down at the bottom, there's the search bar and things like that. That is part of Windows. So that's the Windows taskbar. So if you hit F11, what you end up seeing is this. So it hides that stuff, giving that extra room for content of that particular window. In this case, all that part that is in green, you'll see that much more real content. If you look in File Explorer, it works there as well. And in its normal state, you'll see it here with 9 files showing. And if you hit F11, it's going to take away what you see highlighted in red. And in this case, then you can see 15 files. So it just gives you that ability to see more content, which is what you presumably are trying to use your program for.
It's a good one to remember for YouTube as well. Because if you're full screen, you're looking, okay, so how do you get out of full screen? Well, you hit F11.
True. Yep. Yeah, F11 is a really good one to try, and it works in a wide array of programs. So give it a shot.
Josh says it doesn't work in Zoom.
Okay. Yeah, it doesn't work everywhere. It's up to the application programmers whether they want to implement it or not. But there are some that have done it. So
you can always try Escape.
Yep. Okay, anything else? I don't think so.
No.
Okay. So we will go on because the next one is mine as well. And this I got a real chuckle out of. Leo Notenbaum. He has a YouTube channel, Ask Leo, and he's got really good explainer videos. And this one here he came up with, Why Computer Literacy Matters to You, and he titled it, Okay, Boomer. And his big things in this are, quit complaining that all of us older folks are being perceived as a generation of grumpy old farts who stopped learning years ago. Mm-hmm. And he says, progress is nothing new, and this is true. I mean, we've all gone through a lot of progress. And you've embraced it before, back in the early days of computing. Why not embrace it now? And he says, learning new things is good for you. And the less you know, the more isolated you become. And he comes down to the final line of it. It's required. In order for you to participate in society, you have to be technologically literate. And the more you know, the better off you'll be. It's a good video to watch. I highly encourage people to take the 5 or 10 minutes or whatever where you'll actually be able to see all his comments. And there's the URL, and I will paste that in as well. Actually, I'll paste in the next two because the next one is mine as well. So the next one, we'll move on. And this is by CIRA, the Canadian Internet Registration Authority. They're the people who hand out or handle the .ca domain for Canada. And they have a pretty neat article on whether you should build your own website. And so a lot of people, they think, you know, it might be a good idea to have a website. And should you farm it out to somebody else who really knows what they're doing, or can you do it yourself? And they have a sort of checklist that you can go through. You know, how complex is it going to be? How much time do you have? You know, how much money do you have? Do you want to learn a little bit more about, you know, web pages and things like that? Because you typically will have to learn a little bit at least. How critical is it to your business? It does have a business focus about it, but it is applicable to home users as well. And they do a quick overview of actually building your own website. And then, as I say, it is focused on small businesses, but there is applicability to personal websites as well. And so if you have any interest in actually generating your own website, then check it out. And it looks like I missed the URL for that last one, so I'll paste in the URL as well on that. And that's it for that one.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. If we can just go back to the keyboard shortcut, Sheridan says that F11 is page up. So do I need a combination key?
If F11 is being used by your program to be page up, then I would presume they have not implemented that way of removing that extraneous stuff. So you probably don't have the ability within that particular program. But okay. It should work in things like browsers and File Explorer as a minimum.
All right. Thanks very much, Chris. Okay. The next share is Stuart's fault. And he got me using Patch My PC several years ago. And for me, it used to work really fine as a portable application. I had it loaded in a folder. I would run it when I needed to run it, and it worked just fine. But recently, I've noticed that when I do my backup, every time I finish a session, I plug in an external flash drive, and then I back up my active data drive to this USB flash drive. And you can see here it's showing me files that have been edited, or new files on the left folder, which is my data drive, and they're going to be backed up with the green arrows to the USB drive. But you notice that it's decided that the portable EXE file and the log file have both changed, and so it wants to back them up. And it never used to do that. And it's not a big deal. The log file is getting updated somehow, but I didn't understand what was going on, because if it's a portable version, it should run when I tell it to run. And obviously, it's basically running every day, and every time I try to back my system up, it's trying to back up this log file. So I did what Chris suggests, and I talked to Perplexity AI, I think this is, and I said, why does the portable version run every time Windows loaded and updates the log file? And it says, well, it's designed to run on demand, but it can auto launch because of all kinds of things. So it gives you a list of things to check here. And I went through and I checked them all, and I couldn't find anything that was going on. Eventually, I asked it, well, how do I stop it doing that? How do I just disable this auto start business? And it basically gave me these PowerShell commands. So this stuff right here, you notice I stuck it in my maintenance log. So now when I run into this problem, I just go to this, I search for Patch My PC, grab these lines of PowerShell code, and you notice what it's doing, it's disabling the scheduled task, essentially. So I grab those lines, copy them, paste them into PowerShell, and run them, and it basically disables the Patch PC task. So next time it doesn't update the log, and I don't have to worry about things changing. So I find that it's annoying, but it's a useful kind of workaround to stop it happening. Okay, and as I forecast, for once in our lives, we're in the last 10 minutes, and we have time for questions. So if anybody has any questions, any comments on what we've talked about, any answers that we haven't given already, now's the time to put up your hand, open up your microphone, type something in the chat window, and we'll see what's going on.
We have something from Tom. Is there a program integrated with a VPN that automatically chooses which country server to use for native access to local internet TV program or service, i.e. pick a program or channel, then auto-navigate? I do not know myself. Does anybody know of a service that will do that?
I'm not aware of either any, but I would be interested in the answer as well.
Yeah. I mean, it certainly looks like a very useful thing.
So, Tom, have you asked AI?
I could do that.
There we go.
Have we done a presentation on when to get a USB hub versus a docking station? No.
I would think the major difference, I would think, between the two of them is that a USB hub is just a USB hub, and you can get powered ones and non-powered ones. So If you had a non-powered one, you'd have to use it with devices that don't require power at all, or very, very minimal power. If you have things that require a lot of power, you would want a powered hub for sure. A docking station usually will also include things like video ports and things like that.
And Ethernet, maybe.
And Ethernet, yeah, that's right. So I think if you have a need for external monitor being plugged in through another device or an Ethernet cable, then looking for something that is a, as they say, rather than being a hub, is giving you that docking station type thing. I don't know of any other major differences. Anybody else know any differences that would be between a docking station and a hub?
Well, the main difference is that a hub just has whatever it has on it, and it's usually more ports, more USB ports, and sometimes a little bit of extra stuff. But a docking station is meant to kind of stick around that at your office, or I suppose in your home office. And so it definitely has things for video and especially for cable internet. So they're cabled internet. So it has to have those, and then anything else is extra. So it depends on what you prioritize, more USB ports or being able to plug into your machinery where you have your office.
Yeah, the docking station, normally people would use it to plug in a laptop so that you can access a real keyboard, a real mouse, and maybe a big monitor.
Right.
Rather than use just the screen and the keyboard touchpad on the laptop.
Yeah,
and say you can also do it both in the office and at home. So the people who are working, it's quite useful, I think.
And some of them will also supply power to the laptop, so you could charge your laptop while you're plugged into the docking station.
USB hubs are really useful these days because laptops don't come with very many USB ports typically. You know, this thin and light thing means you don't get any ports. So you plug one, you use one USB port to hold a hub, and then you might have six or eight USB ports on the hub.
We do have a comment going back to the VPN stuff from Tristan saying that Private Internet Access has an application you can install for their VPN. Lets you select what country their destination VPN service is in. So that is a possibility. Karen asks, can you talk a little bit more about GitHub? I hear a lot of people reference it, but don't really know what it is.
Let's postpone that, Chris. That's a good topic for Q&A.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, we could.
A couple of people got their hands up, too. So, David, go ahead.
Yeah, I've been working on a lot of laptops that I get from people because they won't run Windows 11. So I get this laptop. Battery's dead. There's no charger. So, okay, now I got to go buy a charger and then hope the thing works. So I went out and I bought one of these universal chargers, and it's got just a plain pigtail on the end, but it comes with a whole bag of a different variety of ends. So whether it's HP or Acer or Asus or Dell, it'll work with any of them. And that way I don't have to buy an adapter for this thing just to try it and then find out that the battery's pooched and it's not worth even putting Linux on. So if anybody works on a lot of laptops, that's the way to go. It's really neat. Anyhow, that was my only comment. Thanks.
Do you have a URL where that can be?
No, it came off Amazon.
Okay.
Okay, thank you very much. So just for people who are not familiar with Zoom, if you go to, what is it? I can't see it on this thing. It's React, I think, isn't it? You go to React, and if you open that, you'll find a raised hand. And when you do that, you get this, like Steve Park in the top right-hand corner of my screen. He's got a little yellow hand showing, and his thumbnail pops up to the top of the list. So we know that he has a question. So go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I was just wondering about the USB hub. Does it use anything else other than the USB connection? Because I know a docking station will use all the KVM stuff, won't it? as well as the hub.
The hub I have only has power in and USB out.
Yeah, so a hub is basically an extension of the USB bus, right?
Yeah, but it might be powered, as Chris said.
Yeah, power as well as video, because a lot of the laptops will have the ability to feed video through the USB port.
And audio as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Same as an HDMI cable does.
Yep, yeah. So I guess it's dependent on your laptop, what functionality it will actually push through the USB, how much functionality. I know that these docking stations, it used to be with laptops, you would get a laptop, and it actually had a proprietary connector for a docking station, and they actually called it that, and you had to buy the docking station from that manufacturer, and it would give you then on the other side of it all of the things like extra ports out, including video, audio, all of those sort of things.
Yeah, my Dell laptop has that.
Yeah.
The docking station is almost as expensive as the darn laptop itself.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. But now it seems they've all gone to docking stations that are just USB-based, and so, yeah, you just have to make sure that your laptop exposes that functionality through the USB ports, and then you could use a docking station that is USB-based for that additional functionality.
I bought an interesting sort of USB hub. It's actually a monitor mount. It's a telescopic, so your monitor, it has a VESA mount on it, so you can mount your monitor right on it, and it has it's powered and it has additional USB ports, so it's built right into your monitor stand, rather sort of takes up good handy on the desktop.
There's also a company called NextDock, I believe, that specializes in making docking stations for high-end Android phones. So you can turn your phone into a laptop. And it was sort of like what the Apple has done with their new laptop, the Neo. NextDock was doing it with Android 10 years ago.
Motorola did that for some of their high-end phones 10 or 20 years ago.
Yeah, Motorola too.
Richard has an interesting comment here in the chat. If you do a clean system and app install and only backup and restore data, beware that certain Windows updates prevent reinstalling of some earlier equipment drivers. That's kind of ugly. I wonder why that Microsoft has decided that those are not compatible, or I don't know. That could be a nasty surprise for you for sure. I don't know, Richard, do you have any comments on how people should actually react to, or not react to, but how they should actually deal with that issue?
Well, I've had a couple of examples recently, sort of related, in that two friends had updates on Windows 11, and in both cases, Microsoft had actually deleted the LibreOffice program.
Oh, my God.
That literally been deleted. We were able to reload it and it continued running. It's I've got another thing where I had a new machine. And you see that? It's a little writing pad for entering Chinese. And I had a computer fail and I've started up on a new computer. And Windows would no longer let me reload the driver for that writing pad. So it's a sort of complicated driver software that actually included all the Chinese character sets, whatever, for recognizing on this writing pad. And I've also seen more documentation on Windows 11 that they are actually deprecating drivers for earlier printers. So they're no longer allowing earlier print drivers to be loaded. So though I think their excuse is some sort of security reasons, but I wouldn't have thought print drivers would be too much of a security risk if you're in a secure system.
Yeah, actually, I did hear of that before, though, a couple of years back, where there was a big issue with Microsoft had tightened down security around printing, and it caused a lot of failures. But I didn't hear any more details about that for sure. It's a kind of real nasty surprise if you run into one of those.
Yeah, well, I've got two little Fuji Xerox laser printers, and when I tried to reload them, the drivers were no longer there, and in fact went to this Fuji Xerox website. They no longer had the drivers, as they decided they were obsolete printers, but I did manage to get the drivers off a third-party site and reloaded them in and finally got them running, but it was a bit messy.
Mm. Yeah. Shades of Microsoft declaring that Windows 10 computers can't be upgraded to Windows 11 for arbitrary reasons that only Microsoft knows, I guess.
Well, you never know when a company or a government is going to decide something is a security risk.
Yeah.
Right now, the United States is forbidding the sale of any new foreign-made modem or routers.
Routers, yeah. I read about that.
Yeah, new types. It's not the new modems. It's just that they have to be pre-approved. And all the ones so far are pre-approved because they're pre-approved.
Yeah,
they say that. But any future models have to also be approved by the FAA or DOD.
Which I would strongly suspect that they're not going to approve any.
By USA. Ooh,
yeah, exactly. Not that there are any made in the USA.
It's going to take a year to put the plant together and get it stocked, and then they'll end up charging you another $10 for your internet because now the router is worth $600 instead of $200.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? Exactly,
yeah. Real likely.
We'll just pass it on to the consumer. Yeah.
Another V8 router.
Okay, we got all kinds of other comments and things in the chat about, in particular, docs as well as the VPN stuff. So anybody interested in those particular topics, you can pick up the chat for those comments and URLs that are in it. Thank you, people, for contributing those inputs. I think given our time, we should go ahead and wrap up the session. We just got the final slides from Alan.
Okay, so Chris and I keep telling people about the benefits of being a club member, and one of the things I find amazing is that only about, I think it's about a third of the membership belongs to the member forum, and this is where you're not limited to asking questions on Wednesday nights. This thing runs 24/7, so you can post questions and read answers or just post things that are generally interesting. However, only club members can access the group. You need to be authorized, and Chris is the king as far as that goes. And you can access it by email, or you can go on the website, but this is a password-protected area of the website, so you need to be a member to be able to do that. And if you want to subscribe to the forum, then you go to this link, which is on the bottom of the homepage, the how-to page for Google Groups. I kind of thought about this because we had a question came in to the forums a couple of days ago, and it came in at 7:56 in the morning, and the question was about essentially a replacement for Microsoft Lens, which is a scanning-type application. So the question came in, what's the alternative to Microsoft Lens at 7:56? And at 8:05 and 8:06, Harvey and Stuart both replied with answers. So what's that, 6 or 8 minutes maybe or something, to get an answer. So that's pretty good. And I just emphasize it's only for members. So if you're not already a member, as Chris said earlier, this is the last call for our special offer for this year. And $20 for a one-year membership gets you a second year of membership absolutely free. So it's 2 years for the $20 price of a one-year membership. Bridget is always looking for articles for the newsletter. The cupboard is not quite there, but it's not exactly overflowing with scripts. So if you have any computer-related information that you would like to share with club members in the form of a newsletter article, then Bridget would like to hear from you. Our OPL presentations at the library. Linda is going to be doing how to take better vacation photos at Nepean Center Point on Saturday at 2 o'clock. And Chris has got artificial intelligence at Rosemount Branch on Monday the 30th. That's at 6 o'clock. And then how to buy a digital camera at Carlingwood on Monday at maybe 11th at 6 o'clock. So a long lead time for that one. Looks like we're coming in between seasons here. Linda's also going to be busy in a couple of weeks. April the 8th, she's going to be our speaker for the monthly meeting on restoring old photographs. But before that, April the 1st, and this is not a joke as it says, April the 1st will be next Wednesday. That will be our next Q&A session. So if you have questions or topics that you'd like to share, like the things that Stuart and Jeff and Elizabeth sent in, send us all the details and we'll put together the slides on a presentation day. So we've run a bit over time tonight, but I hope everybody enjoyed the banter, and we'll see you next Wednesday.
And Richard, I see your question in the chat. We will put that in for next Wednesday. So if you can show up next Wednesday, maybe somebody will have an answer. So thanks, folks, everybody, for showing up, and hope to see you next week.